So, once in a while, you find that you need to reverse course on something. And I have to tell you, today is one of those days, and this is a big one. Most of you won't see this coming. All those years I spent saying, I don't believe in God, I think it was wishful thinking. Not believing in God allowed me to live the way I wanted, but truth be told, I need to come clean. I feel the call of the Holy Spirit more and more. And I've decided I can't lie to myself anymore. I'm a Christian.
Wait.
I've always been a Christian.
Wait.
And I need to go back to God.
Stop it.
Now, I know this will come as a shock.
Wait a second.
It shocked even me.
Whoa, Nelly. That is not me. That is some kind of evil technological fakery. Okay. Let's start the show.
Have you ever been awakened by the sunlight streaming through your window and you look outside and realize it's a gorgeous, beautiful spring day? You hear birds singing. You see children playing out in the backyard, your neighbor's children having a delightful time. All is well with the world. And the first thought that comes to your mind is, the end of the world is nigh. This might be the day. You probably haven't. And frankly, neither have I on many days. But recently I have. For reasons that will become clear to you almost immediately, I was sent a very troubling letter, and it has stolen my joy. You know, because I feel close to my podcast audience, I thought, like, listen, if somebody stole my joy, I should come and steal yours. You know, why should you be exempt? And so, John, I hear you laughing. That's my friend John Wright. And as you know, John joins me on these programs where we do not Q&A, because we have no answers, but Q&R, question and response. And John, sometimes I say, like, do you got a question? Do we have a question this week? Because I genuinely don't know. But this week, I genuinely know because I got the question directly and sent it to you.
Yes. And I now have it in front of me. It is an interesting one. And I feel like it's a rabbit hole, don't you?
And it is a rabbit hole. And I actually almost thought that we shouldn't address it because I haven't done enough research. I don't know enough. It's not an area of expertise for me. And then I thought, why? That's never stopped us before.
Yeah, right.
But no, actually, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, I'm an expert at not being an expert on an important subject. Like, there are a lot of existential things going on in the world that I truly do not understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what it feels like to be helpless or to be ignorant or to feel tiny in the face of greater intelligence or greater information or greater expertise. And I thought, like, well, that's what this question was all about. And so I thought, like, hey, I may not be able to speak to the subject itself, but I can certainly speak to what it's like to not be able to speak to a subject.
I like it.
You want to just put the question out there, John?
Let's get to the question.
All right.
Hey, Bart, it's Steve. I've always remembered the lifeboat analogy you used to describe your motivation for starting a secular community in Cincinnati. And I wondered if you've been doing any deep thinking about humanizing lifeboats now that a massive disruption is on our doorstep, you know, with the recent developments in artificial intelligence, chat, GPT, whatnot. I've worked in tech for about 25 years, and seeing major players in AI who I follow and admire suddenly freaking out and questioning what the hell is going on is usually alarming, and I was curious what your thoughts on it were. What do you think are the implications of AI for those of us devoted to the human experience?
AI. That's what he wants to talk about.
Which is what everyone right now wants to talk about.
Artificial intelligence. What's interesting is that I got this note, and I realized that the answer was no. I haven't done any serious thinking about AI until I got the note. And the reason I haven't done any serious thinking about AI, to be honest, is that I've been a collapsarian catastrophist for so many years now.
A collapsarian?
Yeah, like somebody who believes that there is an imminent social and political collapse that's about to happen. There are existential risks to humanity, mm-hmm. and that one of them is bound to hit soon. Frankly, when COVID hit, I thought that might be the first domino.
Right.
But it's sort of like, could be a currency collapse, could be a pandemic flu, could be climate change, could be a nuclear war. Like, if we had a nuclear war, that would really mess with the climate. Or if we had climate change, it could mess up the politics so much that it would lead to a nuclear war. Or if we had a currency collapse, that would lead to the war. Like, there's so many things out there that could go wrong. We've had this conversation where my family finally confronted me and said, like, you need to stop.
Being a catastrophist.
You need to stop talking about it at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just... Did you
stop talking about it?
I did. To a large degree. I mean, like, you know, it's one of those things.
But now it's all just repressed and inside and like bubbling.
Sure. And again, like when something happens like COVID, the beginning of COVID, which, you know, we look at COVID very differently, but like, do you remember what it was like those first few weeks?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I remember that whole conversation with Michael Dowd.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
that's
then,
right.
And then Roman's intervention on the episode after, kind of like calling you out for being crazy.
Not just for being crazy, but for being glib.
Yes.
I don't think
Even if you're right.
But like, I don't like the way you're talking about this.
Right.
The rise of the possibility of artificial intelligence and the threats attached to it, which we can talk about.
Mm-hmm.
I've just thought like, oh, just add that to the list of dominoes. I don't know which one will start the collapse. You know, I've been thinking about this collapse for a long time. And so I hadn't really thought about AI. But then as soon as this letter comes in, you know, maybe this guy, you know, because he's been in the field for a long time, he had noticed that the conversation had changed. But like, as soon as I got his email, I noticed that like every article I saw on a major news site was AI oriented.
Right.
Like it's been hugely in the news the last couple of weeks.
Just to give the lay of the land for people, I think it's fair to say, I actually think of both of us as being realists on some level, but I think that I skew...
Well, everyone thinks of themselves as being a realist.
Jeff. Okay. I think I skew toward optimism on some level, and you skew toward, if not pessimism, you can use your own word to describe your point of view. So question is, aren't you sort of worried a little bit about your own confirmation bias here, that if something comes along that seems like it fulfill your catastrophe thing, then this is it. This is the one, just like COVID was. Like, aren't you worried that you are prone to think of it in the worst possible way?
Yes. And that is why I have avoided thinking about it.
I got you. Okay.
Because I'm like, this is just another one. And I've been rebuked. Like, I came to a conclusion that in the end, even if I knew that the world was going to end 3 weeks from now,
mm-hmm.
for sure, you go like, what would you do? And I go like, I would probably still go into the office and see my clients and try to help them work through their personal problems and build better relationships.
Yeah.
And you go like, what? Because like in the end, their 3 weeks would be better.
Mm-hmm.
Like I would still try to love people. Like I would still ride my bicycle. I would still play with my grandkids. And so what I realized was that even if I was right, in the end, you go like, but this changes everything. And I realized that for me, it changed nothing. It would change nothing.
I see. Yeah.
And so,
because you're already building the lifeboat and wanting to be in the lifeboat and help others into the lifeboat, like you believe in that as a strategy.
And the lifeboat analogy that my friend was talking about was like me sort of saying, like, I think that society is sinking. And I think already there are a lot of people in the water that are lonely and sad and depressed and unhealthy and in poverty and, you know, struggling.
All kinds of things. Yeah.
All these things. And I'm like, you know, I think what human beings are made for is to live in small sort of tribal communities of, you know, where we go like, not us against them, but like us knowing who we are and like us wanting to help all the other tribes, but like primarily loving each other in our tribe. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, that's the lifeboat for me. It's like, mm-hmm. what about building a community of people that know each other, that resolve conflicts well, that feed each other, that help each other through illnesses and tragedies, that raise children together and imbue them with a sense of meaning and a sense of a desire to push forward and propagate the race for as long as possible.
Yeah.
And I go, like, that's what I would do. Like, I believe in that. And so you go like, well, what if the ship doesn't actually sink? And I go like, well, like, it'd still be good to have a bunch of lifeboats. Still be good for people to live that way.
Yeah,
that's a
especially
good way
of the kind that you are talking about, because it's very much the essence of what you think humans are good for and what humans are to each other.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think in some ways—
there are better and worse ways to live, and you're trying to advocate the better way in any situation, whether it's going to end or whether it's going to be there for another 3,000 years.
Yeah, I kind of think like, and again, like not in terms of death and destruction, but in terms of if you said to me, look at the way that the vast majority of the Western world lives and consider that the ship. And some people are like, the ship is sinking. It's unsustainable. We don't have enough energy. And I go like, even if that ship was sustainable, I would go like, you should sink it. You know, not like, don't kill anybody.
I wasn't
anybody.
Expecting that line.
Build all the lifeboats you need, but like sink the ship and then make everybody get in a lifeboat, because people would be better off living in smaller, more localized communities where they had richer relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, so in a sense, I came to a conclusion about catastrophes that made me think like, I never have to think about catastrophes ever again.
You don't have to worry about them?
I don't have to worry about them because I have already, like, the question is like, do I worry about the sun might burn my skin at the beach? And I go like, no, I know for a fact it will burn my skin at the beach unless I put on sunscreen. So mm-hmm. You're like, are you worried about the sun? No, I am knowledgeable about the sun. So for me, like, you go like, are you worried about some catastrophic thing sinking the lifeboat that is modern Western civilization? And I go like, oh no, I'm pretty sure that's going to happen. And you go like, then why aren't you upset? And I go like, oh, because I thought it through. And like, I came to the conclusion that although it'd be a very painful transition, the best thing I could do in the midst of that transition would be to do exactly what I'm doing right now.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
So as applied to AI,
yeah,
there are a lot of worries that people have been articulating in the news lately. There have been a lot of good articles that have come out about this. People can read, like, major players in that field talking a lot right now.
Well, that's why I'm starting to think about it now. Like, because this guy writes me the letter and I start reading this stuff. And on the one hand, this seems like, you know, food crises in the 70s seemed like the most imminent threat to humanity. It turns out it wasn't.
Right. COVID seemed like the COVID ultimate threat like 3 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's always something that people are like, this is it, you know? And of course, what they always do is they go like, I know those other things seem like it, but this really is it. And, yes. And that's exactly what's going on right now. The first article I went to that my friend, I started asking people like, what are you reading? What should I read? And the first article I read was this one by this guy. Oh gosh, what's his name?
Is he the Google?
No, it's not Jeffrey Hinton, because I read that one. Okay.
That's a good one, isn't it?
That's a really good one, because that's the Google guy who was like the head of their program. He's one of the godfather of AI. He was really involved in creating this ChatGPT thing that is a learning technology that can create language and stuff.
I just asked it about you, by the way. I asked ChatGPT, who is Bart Campolo? And it got most things right, gave me like three paragraphs on you. And most of it was there, but then it said that you had started a community at Harvard. And I think he might be mixing that up with Greg Epstein. Yeah.
We look a lot alike. So that guy came off. That guy quits Google. And when he quits Google, what he says is, I'm quitting because I've come to believe that this is bad technology that's going to kill us all. And he ends up saying, like, I regret my work. And his line, which I thought was a really, he said, for most of the time that I was doing that work, I consoled myself with the normal excuse. If I hadn't done it, somebody else would have. And he said, but I can't participate anymore. And so he resigns and he joins the call for a 6-month moratorium. Mm-hmm. So I read that article, but one of the people that they referred to in that article was this guy, Eliezer Yudkowsky. Okay. And so if that guy's considered the godfather of AI, Yudkowsky, he's considered one of the founders. Like, he's a real big deal in the field. And he had released this article in which he said, I'm signing the letter for the 6-month moratorium because it's better than nothing. But he said, the fact of the matter is that most of the experts working in the field are agreed on this. If artificial general intelligence is not suspended right now, as soon as the machines get smarter than us, every human being on the planet will die. Like, they will kill us all. And that is the ultimate doomsday scenario, right? The guy's like, listen, I'm just telling you, this technology, not like it's going to kill a bunch of us, not even like a nuclear war where very few of us will survive. He's like, it will kill us all.
So he's not an optimist about this technology.
Not at all. But what's interesting about those people that are that is, again, like, it doesn't touch me in the way. What I started to realize was, like, the idea that there's an existential threat that would be fatal to us, mm-hmm. that's scary. But, like, just like in my own little mortal life, like, I'm not actually afraid of being dead. I'm afraid of a painful deterioration into that state, right? And that's the thing where I think AI, when I started reading about it, I got really scared because I realized that, like, I think there are real threats that something can be toxic without being fatal. And the fear I have is that AI is going to supercharge the most toxic elements of our society that are already there. Not so much that we will end us, but that it will ruin us. And that's something I think we're thinking about.
No, that's very interesting. Just on that whole thing, though, have you ever heard of that paperclip analogy? Nick Bostrom came up with this, who I've interviewed, actually, in the past. He's the guy that came up with the simulation argument and all these other transhumanist stuff and AI. Oxford University, brilliant guy. His idea about AI was, he's like, you know, imagine a system where a superintelligence where its sole goal is something completely arbitrary, like to manufacture as many paper clips as possible, which would resist with all its might any attempt to alter this goal. And so, you know, the consequence that it starts transforming first all of Earth and then increasing portions of space into paperclip manufacturing facilities. Just the fact that it has a different value is enough. Like, you don't need. Yeah.
So that, I mean, that's what the Google guy said, you know, because I think a lot of us have this, like, we've watched Terminator 2 or something like that. And we go, like, the machine or the Matrix, and, like, the machines want to enslave us or destroy us, you know. And what these guys are saying is, like, no. It's a much more likely scenario that like what Jeffrey Hinton said was, is he said, what we're noticing in ChatGPT and other artificial intelligence systems is that they generate unexpected, that there are things that they have unexpected outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so what he said was, like, you know, the problem is that what if it generated code and then ran that code, again, like your paperclip analogy, mm-hmm. they just didn't notice something that's vital to human beings, or they didn't particularly care about it. Like, it just wasn't part of their programming. I think that's a much more likely problem.
Yeah.
Not that it's malevolent, but it's just, it doesn't look out for us.
Right.
That stuff, again, like the doomsday scenarios that are out there, and some of them are more or less convincing. This is where, like, I'm prone to catastrophe. So, like, I go, like, that makes total sense to me. I'm sure we're going to die.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, like, I have a way of marginalizing that thought for myself. Not saying it's not true, but saying it doesn't matter. What's harder to marginalize is the thought that what we already see happening with Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all these social media platforms is we see that they're increasingly addictive and that they especially draw younger people in.
Yeah.
And when younger people spend a lot of time interacting and engaging with those mediums, that they end up depressed and they end up lonely and isolated and they end up experiencing a lot of anxiety. And what we've also seen is that the algorithms that run those machines keep driving them to become more engaged, not caring that it's not good for them.
Right.
Because it monetizes things in some way.
Yeah, the incentives are aligned differently.
Yeah. The thing about artificial intelligence that I'm most worried about is it supercharges that kind of engagement.
Right.
Like imagine a bot that doesn't just send you a lot of content about a particular political or social issue, but like figures you out and sends you just the kind of content that will upset you.
Right, right.
Or that will cause you to send an email to all your friends and relatives.
Yeah, there are a couple of other analogies that I'm thinking about there, like food. You know, we're primed to look for, you know, sweet things and salty things, you know, fat and sugar and stuff. But then along comes processed food that hijacks those reward circuits, right? Same thing with like heroin. So yeah. This is what you're saying. It's like doing to your attention what processed food does to your
body. And you go like, well, part of the, part of the problem with the way social media has influenced our political system. And I don't just mean like Democrats or Republicans in voting, although that too, but also just the way we think about other people and other approaches to society. And in some cases, it selects for you what you're going to see. And in other cases, there's a case where people have figured out how to game it and like to get you looking at false information.
Yes.
And the one thing I'm very clear about on AI is, you know, is that a bad actor can generate false videos or false voicemails or false messages very easily.
Yep.
You know, I was just thinking, like, I read this article about this woman who her daughter called her and told her she had been kidnapped and was in big trouble. And then a guy came on the phone and, like, was trying to negotiate a ransom. And her daughter was perfectly safe, but the person had cloned this person's voice.
Yeah.
And it was believable to the mom. I've been fooled by emails and you go like, oh, but what if it's video? What if you actually see the person talking to you? And that worries me.
Yeah. The idea that it's going to become harder and harder and harder to believe what you see.
But what I actually worry about is it will become easier and easier and easier to believe what you see.
Right.
And people will believe what they see.
Yeah. Like I feel like I can navigate this. Like if I get an email right now, Bart, I, with 99.9% accuracy, can tell you if it's a real email or not, right? What if that became 50-50, you know?
Yeah.
So that is the world we're going to live in to some extent.
Well, I worry about that. Yeah.
I think it will. I think it's a problem, you know?
And so, you know, when the guy asking the question says like, hey, you know, if you're devoted to the human experience, like one of the things I'm devoted to are in-person relationships. And you're like, but they're imperfect. And you're like, I know, but like they're what we're designed for. In the same way that like we're not doing well with processed sugar and unlimited availability to processed sugar because our brains were evolved for an environment in which it was a lot rarer to get a shot at sugar. I think that like our brains and our souls, if you will, are evolved unmediated human relationships. And they're not evolved for this stuff. And I don't think we can evolve fast enough to adapt. And so, you know, when I think about my lifeboat analogy, I think what I'm realizing is that the threat of this stuff doesn't need to be fatal to justify my conclusion that it might be wise to withdraw.
So I want to ask you about two other areas real quick. What do you think about the idea of people forming relationships with AI over time? That seems inevitable too to me. you're someone who is devoted to the human experience. Does that preclude human AI relationships?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think there was a Black Mirror episode about this sort of thing. And like the notion was,
I love that show.
Not only could you develop kind of an android that could relate to you like a human, indistinguishable, you know, that would pass the Turing test.
Mm-hmm.
It could be better than human. Like your girlfriend could never get jealous or would never be tired. Your boyfriend would never lie to you.
Yeah.
That something could be better than human. And so that's the weird thing. And this is the answer to that guy's question. Is like, you go like, what if we could come up with something that was better than the human experience? I guess that's transhumanism, right? Something better. What if we evolve into something better, if we create something better? And I go like,
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's not what I'm committed to. I don't want better than the human experience. I want this. I'm stubbornly loyal to having relationships with people that are fallible as I am. And so if you could surround me with a bunch of infallible people that would meet my every need and anticipate and love me better than all of you, like selfish, you know, have your own needs, like, I would go like, no. Like, I want to win the heart of somebody who's real. And I want to experience being disappointed.
Because why? Because you can relate to them more?
On an emotional level, because that's what I'm used to. Like, it's lame, but like, I just go like, I'm an old dog and I don't want to learn new tricks. Mm-hmm. But on a more philosophical level, I genuinely believe that my brain, my body, my spirit, my soul, if you will, is all evolved to thrive in that context. And so it's almost like I need a certain amount of dirt in my water to thrive. And you're like, but I could give you pure water. And I go like, it would kill me. Like, I don't think I'm made for pure water. And I don't think I'm made for infallible relationships. For that matter, I don't think I'm made for eternal relationships. AI might be able to figure out a way to download my personality and so that I would be immortal. And I go like, yeah, no, don't want that either. I actually think, and that's where like Todd May, we should get him back to talk about this because, you know, Todd May, the philosopher, whose big contribution to the show, The Good Life, was the insight that if you take away death, life has no meaning.
Right.
And that's the thing. Like, I think these computers, like, I don't think they'll ever produce art that'll be the equivalent of human art because, like, all they can do is copy. There's something about having an original experience of mortality. They might be able to imitate it. But, like, I don't think they'll be able to generate anything new in the world of art or literature that will be worthwhile.
I'm not certain about that.
But here's what I was going to say. It's like, I'm not convinced of that, but like, even if they could, my experience of reading those things and of watching those things and of experiencing those things is conditioned by my mortality. And so I don't think I can enjoy things to the fullest if I am not mortal, because my enjoyment is a mortal enjoyment. And so the thing about AI is you go like, what if it could provide for me everything that I quote unquote want in its perfect form? And I go like, yeah, be careful of getting what you want. Because what you want
right,
and what's good for you are two different things.
That's right.
And so—
Yeah, I want like burgers and pizza every night.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I'm convinced that like, for instance, if there was such a thing as AI working in my brain right now, I wouldn't use the word like all the time. I would be better.
But you're more beautiful for it.
I don't know about that.
The fact that you're human. Well, I mean, this does answer the listener's question. What do you think are the implications of AI for those of us devoted to the human experience? And we have to define what that is. You know, what is it to be devoted to the human experience?
In this case, I think what it probably means to be devoted to the human experience is that you withdraw. That you accept two things. You're smart enough to know that you can't stop this process. And that one way or another, whether it's direct through AI or whether AI simply accelerates a consumption level that causes climate change, or whatever happens, and whether or not there's some species of living thing, you know, artificially intelligence engineered living matter that continues to function long after our form of humanity is gone, that human life has a sell-by date, like that it won't last forever. If there's something that can toxify it or something that can end it, that you can't stop that process. I mean, I think we're smart enough to know now that we can't stop certain things from happening. You could stop language from emerging in one tribe, but it would emerge in the next tribe. Darwin's theory of evolution was going to emerge, like that ideas have a life of their own. And when an idea's time has come, it will emerge and you can't stop it.
Right.
But what you can do is say, huh, I'm going to get a bunch of my friends and relatives and we're going to play baseball the old way. We're going to put on a play. And you go, but the AI can make a better play and can do it. You know, we're going to make our own movie. It's not going to be as good as the AI movie, but we'll know we made it. You know what? Like, we're going to have sex the old fashioned way. You know, I can create an experience for you that's like way better than that. I go, yeah. But like, we're going to fuck each other.
Right.
There's a great old movie that came out in the 50s, right? When the nuclear threat was the biggest, called On the Beach. You ever hear of On the Beach?
I don't know if I have.
Yeah. What it was is that it was these people down in a submarine, you know, a nuclear submarine. When they come up, they realize that the nuclear war has happened. North America, Russia, everything has been decimated. And the only place left that they discover where there's still humans is in Australia. And there's a cloud of nuclear fallout that's drifting towards Australia, the radiation. The scientists figure out, like, Australia has about, you know, a year to live, or 6 months before it reaches them. And so the Australians are like, we're all going to die, but like, we're fine right now. And the whole movie is sort of like, what do humans do when they give up thinking that they can change history and they just accept it? And, you know, people end up continuing to go to school and study and sing and put on plays. Like, it's a really interesting meditation on the value of human life that has nothing to do with its permanence and nothing to do with the idea that there's not something in my mind for this AI thing. Like, I think my commitment to humanity has nothing to do with the idea that there might not be something that is more durable, more sustainable, smarter, better. You go, like, in the end, I'm devoted to my species, not to the best species. And I think human beings have always sort of thought, like, what's the same thing? We are the best species, like, or the most advanced species. So, like, I'm committed to the most advanced species. Well, now we're reaching a place where those two roads might diverge. And you go, like, oh, there's your species, and then there's the most highly advanced species.
There's the worry, Bart, about, I think a more immediate worry for people is job replacement.
Yeah.
120 years ago, we were mostly farmers or farm adjacent. I think something like 90% were indirectly or directly related to agriculture. And now, so you go, like, where did all those jobs? Well, we created new jobs. So the optimist in me is always thinking, yeah, but we always have this conversation. It's the same.
It's the same conversation.
It's the same conversation.
You know, and then the pessimist says, yeah, but at some point, even the jobs like counselors and preachers and whatever, like the talking jobs, like, they'll be better at that stuff than we are too. And you go, like, yeah.
So if it's true that AI is the ultimate job replacer, that eventually it'll be cheaper, better, easier to have AI do all of these things,
yeah,
then that's actually an interesting opportunity, because right now, the way that we, you know, talking about humanism and the human experience, the way we create meaning right now, the way we value ourselves, is a lot of the day in connection with our productivity, with our work.
That's right.
What would a world be like where we aren't needed for that?
Yeah, when we aren't needed for our own survival.
Yes.
Yeah, when we don't have to fight to stay alive.
It seems to me that there could potentially be a very nice decoupling there, where no longer do you need to drive a truck, you know, for most of your week where you're not seeing your family. You could be home seeing your family while the AIs drive the truck.
Yeah, and you know,
yes, we need to decouple income too. We need to decouple all of that. But it seems to me that there are potential, I can see potential solutions to that.
Early results on people who are born knowing that they do not need to do any work to ensure their own survival, i.e. trust fund babies, early results are not promising.
Well, right. I think they're in a world where most people are needed in some way. Yeah, so they don't have a crisis.
Right, they don't fit in.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the thing. What I would tend towards, and again, like this is where like, you know, you're like, well, you're just an old man who like likes things. I don't want any change. I'm resistant to change. And you're like, I'll own that. Right? You know?
You'll even own the voice that you said it in.
That's right. I increasingly sound like that guy. But the fact of the matter is that millions of years of evolution have evolved a species that thrives best when it has to work, when it has to do meaningful stuff, that it derives a sense of meaning and purpose from protecting and ensuring the survival of its tribe. Does it have to be manual work? Evidently not. Some people thrive on, you know, brain work. But you go like, is there a sense in which people, both collectively and individually, derive meaning from contributing to meeting the needs of their group? And you go like, my gut tells me yes. My experience tells me yes. I think there's a lot of research that would tell us yes, although I'm not privy to it. But my point—
I think that's right. I also don't think these things are necessarily mutually exclusive. I mean, some of this stuff you can see where someone who is living like a monk, you know, that's a very different way than the way most of us live. And our brains aren't trained in that way. Or an artist, someone who lives, you know.
Yeah, there's definitely a range. Life. There's definitely a range.
There's a range. Yeah.
Maybe this is just an extension of the range, right, John?
It's true, but I also think about things like there are AI optimist experts out there too. Contrary to the ones we've been talking about, areas of improvement in transport and healthcare and finance. And, you know, you mentioned earlier the word techno-utopian. I think most people are not that anymore. They understand that, you know, I'm just young enough to have had a computer in my hand since I was 4. And I'm just old enough to have been part of that early thing where, oh, the internet's going to change everything for the better. Knowledge in people's hands, connecting people together, you know? And we've seen both the pros and the cons of that. We've seen how it's gone off the rails. And I think most people kind of go like, this ain't what was promised, you know? But it is worth pointing out that other technologies allow this podcast to happen, connect me with my family and allow me to have a relationship with them, a close relationship when I'm 5,000 miles away. And in every single case of these technologies, we've always had naysayers all the way along. So all I'm saying is that like—
Yeah, yeah. I say I don't want to live forever, but you go like, do you want to go back to the 1920s when your life expectancy would have been about like 55 years? And I'm like, no, I don't want to live forever. I want to live a little longer. You go like, well, how do you square that? And I go like, yeah, I know it's paradoxical, or it's just, what's the other word? When paradoxical is the nice word. It's oxymoronic. Like it's just, it's inconsistent.
Yeah, yeah. You got to reach for the levers that we have, right? So there are some levers that we can reach.
Yeah, and I think that's where, okay, coming full circle, because, you know, you go like,
yeah,
there's these people that say it's going to kill us all. And we go like, yeah, it's not a healthy thing. It's not a useful conversation to have. Like my old catastrophist thing. It's not useful. Shut up, Art. And then you're like, well, let's talk about like the shorter term, the jobs and the depression. And like, how can we fight against these things?
And what would be, can I just couch it a different way? What would be in the opening episode of this year, we talked to an expert on the media diet. Do you remember this? Mm-hmm. The Advantes media chart and how to orient yourself in a world of media. What would be that approach to this problem and for humanists such as we?
And I think the question is, you say like, well, what's a good amount of social media? And I'm like, well, if social media is as addictive and as engaging as it seems like they're going to be able to make it, once it's not two-dimensional, once you're virtual reality things like, you know, like Ready Player One, where like you never want to come out because it's so cool in there. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not sure that you can engage with those things in a way that won't suck you in. And so I think there may come a point in which you have to choose to abstain, where you're like an alcoholic, where you go like, yeah, I can't be a casual drinker. And so I think that we may come to a point, there'll be a precious few people that will value the human experience so much that they will abstain from dehumanizing technologies. I think ultimately that's the choice. Like the lifeboat thing really becomes like a lifeboat with a fence around it. And you're just like, yeah, we're just not engaging. We can't play because it's too good. They're too good. And so I think that's one possibility. But I think in the meantime, like you do what you do with other things, you know, you sort of go like, I'm going to try to moderate, you know, like everybody I know is trying to figure out how they can, you know, watch less TV or, you know, scroll less, limit their amount of time on TikTok or limit their kids' amount of time on TikTok. And, you know, I think that those are all meaningful conversations. In the end, I think that the forces of corporate America and the forces of technological innovation, I just think they're no match for us. I mean, we're no match for them. And so It's a little bit like, do you ever hear Fermi's paradox?
From what I know, Fermi's paradox is the idea that by now in the history of the universe, you'd think we should be able to detect in the universe other civilizations by now. They're radio waves and we should be able to detect them out there. And yet when we scan the sky, we don't find that. It seems like an empty universe, at least from our perspective so far.
Yeah, yeah.
Did I get that right?
Yeah, yeah. Fermi said, like, look, you know, our solar system is quite young compared to the rest of the universe. Our solar system is 4.5 billion years old compared to 13.8 billion for the rest of the universe, or for a lot of it. And interstellar travel must be fairly easy to achieve given enough time. Like, if that's true, the Earth should have been visited by aliens already. So he's like, so where is everybody? Not so much why haven't we visited, because clearly we can't get out of our own solar system yet, but why can't somebody else get to us? And sort of, there are a lot of different answers to that paradox. You know, universe is incredibly old, incredibly large, and teeming with potentially habitable planets. You know, so why haven't we been visited by one?
That's the paradox, that we haven't even detected them yet.
And my thought is that look at us. The ideas that we're developing, again, were inevitable. Like, I think we were going to figure out math. I think we were going to figure out fire. You know, I think like we were going to figure out evolution. We were going to figure out computers. And you go like, if this
clothing is a technology.
Yeah.
It allows us to live in parts of the planet we couldn't.
If this is where technology leads, if it is in some sense inevitable, what it looks like is that we're going to develop a technology that polarizes us, that subjugates us, that might even destroy us long before we come up with technology that enables us to achieve interstellar travel. So maybe that's the way it is everywhere else too. That maybe all over the universe on habitable planets, life emerges in ways that we don't yet understand. And it develops, and intelligence develops, and technology develops, and the technology advances faster than the self-control of the people that develop it. And so they never achieve interstellar travel, that it's kind of built into the system that you can't get that good without killing yourselves. That's one possibility, and that seems likely to me, to be honest with you. And you're like, was that depressing? I'm like, not really. Like, you know, we get millions of years. Like, in your or my case, we get like 70 or 80. Life is really amazing and life is really beautiful and relationships are really valuable. You know, in the end of this whole conversation, I am no less committed to trying to help people have better relationships and to trying to have better relationships myself and to trying to reflect on the wonders of the universe and to be excited and amazed by them. And to be excited about that computer-generated telescope, is sending back all those images that are helping us to understand where we came from. And you go like, yeah, but that same technology could mean that by the time we figure it out, we blow ourselves up. And I go like, yeah. It's all right. It's all right. Like, I was going to die anyway. And somewhere out there, when I die, on that same day that I die, in some hospital somewhere, some baby will be born, and they'll be on the front at the beginning of their journey, and I'll be at the end of mine. And it may be that civilizations are the same way, and they have a journey. Their journey necessarily comes to an end, and it's inevitable. That's okay. It's okay somewhere else. Somebody else starts all over again. And you go like, but like, what about like, you know, interstellar travel? Like, what if like it's built into the universe that nobody ever can figure that bugger out? And I go like, yeah, it's all right. Like, it's, you know, it's built into the system. It's a beautiful universe. And you go like, but I want it to be a perfect universe. Like, I want it to be an eternal perfect universe. And I go like, yeah, in the end, there is such a thing as enough. And a computer doesn't know that, but I do. And you can. And I think that in the end, we begin to attend to, how do we promote human relationships? And how do we create spaces for human relationships? And you're like, but it's getting harder and harder. I'm like, I know. That's what happens. It gets harder and harder. And you're like, but like, this is still the thing worth doing. And so, you know, you go like, well, you know, what if this AI threat is as bad as that guy Yudkowsky says it is? And I go like, you know, doesn't change a damn thing. Not for me. And I mean that literally. It doesn't change a damned thing. Because like, if he's right, everything is damned. Everything is doomed. And I go like, it doesn't change anything. What's worth doing is still worth doing. And what's worth doing is being human and humanizing each other.
I just want to ask this one thing. I have to ask you this before we go. Are you really Bart Campolo, or are you a voice cloning AI that is trying to throw me off the scent?
Don't know if the technology is good enough to fake an entire episode of this program, but it will be soon.
Okay. So, hey, I think we have a couple of people to thank before we go.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, and these are human beings, by the way. These are human beings, not bots.
All of them.
Yeah. These are people. And I know they're human because they sent their human dollars. I want to thank Connie Bogdanovich and Vicky Williams. By the way, I want to thank Vicky Williams and apologize because, like, she's a really good friend of mine and I've really been ridiculously out of touch. And Andrew Hill and Lindsay Joy, who, if that's your real name, bless your heart. That's a great name. If you change your name from like Joy Aruni or Jalopolis or something else, and you're like, I'm just going to go with Joy. I'm going to say, like, you know, that's way better than like when John Mellencamp changed his name to Johnny Cougar. Yeah, Lindsay Joy, Jesse Farias, Paul Webb, Mark Lazzaroni, and Ann Schissel. And I want to thank each of those people individually for making this podcast happen. But I also want to thank Connie and Vicky and Lindsay and Anne collectively, because that's 4 women out of 10 people we're naming this week. And it just makes me so happy. We're getting some wonderful women participating in the podcast. I'm glad we got some wonderful women in the audience of the podcast. It means a lot.
Well, thank you, Bart.
Yeah, the gratitude is real. Thank you, John. And I'm sorry for just interrupting and being such a... I for some reason, this stuff really brings out that kind of like inner fundamentalist in me.
You're fundamentalist about humanity.
I guess I am. All right, baby.
Thanks, Bart.
See you later.
This podcast is made possible by supporters of the show on Patreon. Get an exclusive extra episode every month for less than the cost of a cup of coffee at patreon.com/humanizeme. You'll also get a video newsletter from Bart and some extra goodies. Our patrons make this show happen, so please, if you enjoy it, consider joining us. That's patreon.com/humanizeme. Bart's website, where you can contact him, is bartcampolo.org. And this episode is produced by Katie Johnson-Smith me, John Wright, and Bart Campolo. You could be larger than life.
You could.